As during the Boer War, the British Army drew its horse stocks largely from Canada and the United States. But submarine warfare threatened these supply lines too. On the whole, the First World War resulted in what one American historian describes as a massive forced migration of millions of animals. The reason for the high demand for draft horses was not least the increase in the number and weight of heavy weapons. The enhanced importance of artillery in the First World War was expressed in a far greater demand for traction. Apart from the heaviest siege guns, which needed to be transported by railway, horses were used for the transportation of all light and medium-sized pieces of artillery. It was not an infrequent sight to see teams of 12 or more horses dragging their heavy load along rain-sodden roads, churned up by wheels and grenades, towards the artillery positions, an arduous and treacherous procession. Neither did chemical warfare, launched in 1915, spare the lives of horses. They were also helpless in the face of attack by enemy aircraft. Horses could not duck for cover. That's why it was seen by pilots as more effective to bomb horse-drawn convoys than marching columns. The animals were easier to target and harder to replace than men. By the final climax of the fighting on the Western Front in August 1918, the life expectancy of an artillery horse on the front was 10 days. The number of horses deployed by all parties in the First World War is currently estimated at 16 million, of which half the total, 8 million, met their death before the end of the war. This figure stands alongside an estimated 9 million people killed by the war. The survival rate for animals in the Boer War was even lower. Between 1899 and 1902, of the 494,000 horses employed by the British, some 326,000 died. That is, nearly two-thirds. In the First World War, the loss of horses on the German side is estimated at 1 million, or 68%. It's only very recently that literature, most notably Michael Morpurgo's 1982 children's book, War Horse, adapted for the screen by Steven Spielberg in 2011, and research leading up to the commemoration of the First World War began to recall the achievements and suffering of animals in the war, and especially the horses. Much earlier war literature, and the memoirs that were so popular in the period soon after the war, were not aware of horses. The American naturalist, Ernest Harold Baines, dedicated an early memorial to the fallen animals with his monograph, Animal Heroes of the Great War, and in 1931, Major General Sir John Moore, head of the British Army's Veterinary Corps, paid homage in his pamphlet, Our Servant, the Horse. In Franz Schauwecker's 1928 collection of photographs from the front, he presented pictures of war animals, complemented by a touching narrative. Ernst Johansson ought perhaps to be seen as Morpurgo's direct predecessor, having told the story of the war from the perspective of Lise, a great war veteran mare. His book is dedicated to the 9,586,000 horses, casualties of the Great War, and one of the most shocking scenes in Erich Maria Remarque's novel, All Quiet on the Western Front, is the description in Chapter 4 of the suffering of the wounded horses. Erased from the battlefields of the West, the cavalry lived on in the memories, myths, and political cartoons of the Great War. It made only the occasional fleeting reappearance, like a ghost at noon, in the everyday theater of war. At the end of August 1918, Lieutenant and Company Commander Ernst Junger was wounded in a battle with British troops, as we read in his war diaries. After an emergency tourniquet is applied, Junger is picked up by a comrade by the name of Hengstmann, literally Stallion Man in German, and carried away on his back until he himself is hit by a bullet. Junger was an infantryman, but he had to learn to ride to become an officer. And when he recalls this strange moment in his diary, we hear an echo of the language of the cavalry. I heard a faint metallic buzz and felt Hengstmann collapse beneath me. He had been hit by a shot through the head. It's a curious feeling when a person who is physically so close to you is knocked out from under you. Junger appeared never to have shaken off this surreal scene with its echoes of the legend of St. Christopher carrying Christ. And Junger, seemed in his writing to obsessively seek out the symbolic. The editor of his posthumously published war diary recalled that even in old age, Junger dwelled on the fatal moment and remembered the centurion name of the man who had saved him. Throughout his life, Junger had a photograph of Corporal Hengstmann hanging over his desk. The Nobility Matrix. The fate that awaited horses during the Second World War was hardly any gentler. Progress in mechanization and motorization was still not so advanced that horses were no longer required as draft animals. This was due to the low level of mechanization in many units, the logistical problems, difficulties in the supply of fuel and spare parts, and also the lamentable state of most roads and paths. Where the terrain was impassable for motorized vehicles, where mechanized columns would be engulfed in mud, it was only horse-drawn vehicles that could get through. The historian Reinhard Koselleck experienced the Eastern Front of the Second World War as a member of the horse-drawn artillery. This war too, though bomber planes, flyers, and tanks certainly played the decisive role, was still mostly fought, at least on the German side, by troops reliant on horsepower. While in the First World War, the Germans used some 1.8 million horses, in the Second World War, it was almost a million more, namely 2.7 million, and of these, 1.8 million perished. In terms of percentages, Koselleck concludes, that is a far higher death toll than that paid by the soldiers. He chalks up the figures as evidence of a murderous end to the era of the horse. Compared to the First World War, the demand for horses saw another sharp hike. At the beginning of the Second World War, writes historian Heinz Meyer, an infantry division possessed more than twice as many horses as an equivalent division in the First World War. The greater number of heavy weapons and the more widespread use of such equipment necessitated this increase in the supply of horses. In the non-motorized troops in the First World War, there was one horse for every seven men. In the Second World War, it was more like one horse for every four soldiers. The enormous rise in demand for horses brought its own problems. It did not just take significant capacity away from agriculture and civilian transport. It also meant an escalation of the unit's demand for fodder and required additional military personnel for the care and veterinary treatment of the animals. On top of this, as was becoming increasingly clear in the course of the war in the East, even the fully motorized troops could no longer get by entirely without horses. The state of the roads was simply too dire. Even the smallest vehicles, we read in the April 1942 war diary of a middle-ranking soldier, were often only loosened from the spot by a team of four. The war on the Western Front was conducted largely without horses. The familiar images of helmeted, mounted German officers leading their troops through defeated Paris were just propaganda. Things were different in the East. Here, besides providing draft power, the horse had a genuine cavalry role, even if it was not on the front line. New uses were emerging for the cavalry in the rear guard. With greater distances between the troops, terrain becoming less accessible and guerrilla attacks on the increasingly stretched supply lines on the rise, the military unit, once declared dead, made a comeback. In 1942, a German cavalry unit was deployed under Baron von Boeselager. Their regiments fought alongside both Kalmyk and Cossack Cavalry Corps, as well as the cavalry units of the SS. But these are stories which can be read elsewhere. In technical terms, the war in the East was another, as it were, older war than the one raging in Western Europe, where mechanized armies were grappling with one another and horses played a minimal role. The Russian campaign, writes Reinhard Koselleck, summarizing what he had seen and experienced in the East, with its structural conditions, belongs back in the horse age. It could not be won with horses, and certainly not without them. Again, the same questions arise as had done in the First World War. Why was the cavalry so persistent, and why did so many die? Why did the armies of the West not simply abolish their cavalry regiments after the experience of 1914 to 1918, leaving just the horses for the horse-drawn artillery units, which could not yet give up their old traction engines, and grant the remaining horses leave to return to civilian life? the suggestion that this was the result of the impact of the traditional and conservative spirit of the general staff does not explain everything. Time and again, history gives examples of successful operations by the cavalry, coups, raids, and covert actions that seem to contradict all the naysayers' prophecies of the end of the military cavalry. They include the operations of guerrilla combatants as well as of the cavalry troops who were deployed to combat them. In the First World War, it was the dazzling actions of British commander and cavalryman Sir Edmund Allenby that had his contemporaries spellbound. In 1917 to 1918, his Egyptian expeditionary force drove the troops of the Ottoman Empire out of Palestine. He rode up to the gates of Jerusalem on the 9th of December 1917, and 9 months later took Amman and Damascus. His success gave a polish to the old shield of the cavalry, letting it shimmer in the desert sun. Not far from the battlefields, where once Alexander the Great had shown his enemies what a well-trained, quick, and agile rider was capable of, Allenby's light cavalry triumphed in battle, in a war of combined arms that preempted the blitzkrieg strategy of the next world war. Few observers of the campaigns of Megiddo and Palestine seemed to have recognized that the real secret of Allenby's success lay in the tactical integration of cavalry, infantry, and air force. Most onlookers were intoxicated by the image of the old aristocratic cavalryman gracing the same ground in the theater of war that had once been ridden by the splendid cavalries of Alexander the Great and Napoleon. Immediately after the Great War, the cavalry enjoyed another late renaissance in Eastern Europe. Just as in the earlier Russian Civil War between the Whites and the Reds, the Polish-Russian War of 1919 to 1920 also had substantial cavalry units fighting on both sides. On the Russian side, there was the famous Konarmia cavalry, also known as the Red Cavalry or Budionis cavalry, successful initially until it was thwarted at Lvov and pushed back in the late summer of 1920. On the 31st of August 1920, 10 days after the Russian debacle at Warsaw, Komarow, not far from the headquarters of the Red Cavalry, was host to a cavalry engagement which, yet again, has been described as perhaps the last pure cavalry battle in European history. Although this battle did not decide the outcome of the war, the Polish lancers also dealt a further painful blow to the ailing Red Cavalry. The fast, energetic, and brutal forays by Budionis riders in the early days and later the success of the Polish cavalry provided the desired arguments to advocates of cavalry warfare. As at Warsaw, the siege war, they argued, could have been decided by the tanks, but the horse was far superior to the tank in long and fast offensives. In both Russia and Poland, therefore, prominent cavalry commanders were able to maintain their prestige and their status. And even in Britain, France, and America, argues historian Norman Davies, cavalrymen took heart from what they believed to be the lesson of the Polish campaigns. Military leaders, particularly in the higher echelons, are certainly prone to conservative thinking and traditional attitudes, and a desire to repeat the battles of yesteryear. The First World War is full of examples of this, and Haig and French are merely prominent cases of this professional obstinacy and blinkered thinking. But one of the reasons why the cavalry, in particular, was prone to succumb to this malady of conservatism was the deep-rooted connection it had with the aristocracy, a phenomenon we might call the nobility matrix. The close connection of man mounted on his steed has an aura of inherent nobility to it. It is imbued with an air of mystical faith, a kind of fetish for the dyad of man and beast. But it is also a striking embodiment of an age-old aristocratic bearing, an attitude or pose that suggests distance and superiority. Thanks to the speed and height the mounted position gives man, the cavalier perspective, the horse acts as an excellent medium of distance. A horse grants his rider power at any moment to create a spatial distance, horizontal or vertical, between the rider and the lowly men on foot, his pedestrian entourage. In the collective memory of Europeans, the image of a rider atop his horse, an image which cavalrymen such as Haig consciously evoked, embodies an eternal paradigm of chivalry. Every armed horseman reminds us of St. George. The classic close-range combat weapons, such as the sword and lance, also known as melee weapons, fitted with this sense of distance, even if at first glance that seems paradoxical. Despite all their experience of the continuously growing firepower of the infantry, the cavalrymen of Europe, with very few exceptions, held firmly to the chivalrous idea of hand-to-hand combat. The heroic conception of combat between a cavalry formation armed with short-range weapons charging against the enemy is fundamentally distinct from the artifice of the infantryman who ambushes his opponent or shoots them down from afar like fleeing prey. The cavalry was not only lost in tradition, it was captive to its noble ethos, or what was perceived as such, captive to images of long-gone wars which were still revered for their beauty. Until very recently, the cavalry still claimed to be more than a mere branch of the armed services like the infantry or artillery. It wore the badge of military aristocracy long into the modern era. Even after it had long become obsolete as a military unit, it still paraded itself as a monument to another unforgotten world. The cavalry had its own metaphysics, beside which the physics of the battlefield fell short. The idea of the cavalryman survived his real demise in a hail of bullets. Whenever a uniformed man showed up on a horse, whether or not it was in the carnage of mechanized warfare, the age-old drama was still played out on the stage, a dramatized conflict like a duel of warring peoples, battles over the scraps of cavalry banners, an echo of pomp and circumstance. What we might take from all this is that since the tail end of the 19th century, the cavalry has seen a great number of final battles and died a great number of deaths. Even its death on the 17th of May 1940 was not its last. On this day, a small troop of French cavalrymen, the scattered remains of a regiment decimated by the Luftwaffe, was making its way between Solre-le-Château and Avesnes in northern France, near the border with Belgium. Their end came at the hands of a machine gunner hidden behind a hedge. With the exception of two riders who escaped, every man was killed. One of the two survivors was the future Nobel Prize winner Claude Simon, an author of the Nouveau Roman movement. Simon returned many times to this moment. The colonel riding on ahead, apparently raving mad and desperate for a soldierly death. The shots out of the blue. The flashing sabers held aloft one last time as if ready to attack. The dazzling light. The slow motion collapse, like a slowly tumbling statue. More than once he deconstructed the scene into kaleidoscopic fragments, where, along with the figure of Colonel de Reichsack, the entire world of the aristocracy also perishes as it crashes to the ground, together with its ethos and its pathos, its pride and its folly. He saw him raise the sparkling saber in his outstretched arm, everything, rider, horse, and saber, slowly collapsing to one side, exactly like one of those lead soldiers whose base, the legs, would begin to melt, still seeing him collapse, sink down endlessly, the saber raised in the sun. This famous scene, whose repetition has often given rise to interpretations revolving around the concept of trauma, can also be viewed as an ironic epilogue to the traditions of historical painting and the cavalry portrait. Like Simon, who makes use of this slow-motion narrative device, the 19th century painters solved the problem of the supreme highest point, the acme of motion, by leaving an emphatic sign of the unstable, that which one might call the noumen, the solemn petrification of a pose which it is impossible to maintain over time, as Roland Barthes put it. But the image of the cavalryman's anachronistic final gesture followed by the long, slow descent of man and rider responds not only to artistic traditions, but also, ironically, causes the narrative to disintegrate. The flashing saber is a twinkling hint of the transcendence so long enjoyed by the celestial duality of a man astride a horse. In the next moment, Simon's narrative comes crashing down to the terrestrial, the legendary moment fracturing into a panicked flight, hooves kicking up mud and dust. The last great cavalry units of the world, the Red Armies, survived an entire decade after the end of the Second World War. It was not until the mid-1950s that their regiments were finally disbanded. Hiroshima was a whole 10 years in the past. The Jewish Horsewoman. The Pale Rider. In the years 1984 to 1985, the London-based painter R.B. Kittage was working on an allegorical portrait of a man in a railway carriage. He gave the final work the title The Jewish Rider, Plate 10. The process involved numerous sittings with his model, the art historian Michael Podro. The academic and the artist were long acquainted. In their own ways, both were associated with the Warburg School, which lived on in exile in London and became a powerful influence in British art history. In the late 1950s, Kittage had studied as a young man in Oxford with Edgar Wind, one of the brightest thinkers of the Warburg movement. In his early pictures, Kittage makes several references to art historian and cultural theorist Abby Warburg. In the 1960s, he portrays him as a dancing Maenad. Other giants of the Jewish intelligentsia, such as Walter Benjamin, wander through the world of his paintings. Kittage is a scholarly painter, rather like the poeta doctris, or scholarly writer, in the manner of T.S. Eliot or Ezra Pound, two more of his guiding stars. Podro, for his part, combines strong theoretical interests with a clear inclination towards contemporary art, neither of which is common among art historians. He was also friends with other artists of the London School of Painting, such as Frank Auerbach, for whom he occasionally sat for portraits. Like Kittage, Michael Podro was from an Eastern European Jewish family, and in their work, both reflected the experience of exile and the obliteration of European Jewry. This also created the context for Kittage's portrait of the traveling Jewish scholar. The smoking chimney, whose smoke wafts over to the cross on a mountain, and the peripheral figure of the guard, whose whip gives him the ominous look of a camp overseer or a commanding officer. Among the principles of the Warburg School is the idea that pictorial representations and elemental innovations in form, especially when combined with strong expressive energy, have the potential to travel or roam long distances in time and space. Kittage's painting of the traveling Jewish art historian seems like a commentary on this very idea. The traveler is a wandering Jew, who in turn references the idea of the picture's ability to roam. But Kittage's work is no simple illustration of a theoretical idea. It reads like an erratic translation into a foreign language. Everything begins very simply. The conceptual inspiration behind it, hinted at in both the painting's title and in the posture of its protagonist, is clear to see. Its forerunner is entitled The Polish Rider and is the work of Rembrandt, Plate 6. Since 1910, it has been part of the New York collection of American steel and railway tycoon Henry Clay Frick. It was disputed for a while whether this famous painting could truly be attributed to Rembrandt, although now it is generally confirmed that it can be. Its title, however, is pure fabrication based on the painting's provenance in the collections of Polish aristocracy. It first came to light in 1793 in a list of art treasures owned by the Polish king Stanisław II. Its history before this date is unknown. The title has, over the last century, given rise to many interpretations of the enigmatic young rider it depicts. Most of them link him to Eastern European subjects, including Poles, Hungarians, Cossacks, aristocrats, poets, and theologians, the Mongol hero Tamerlane, the young King David, and the prodigal son have all been touted for consideration. In 1944, the art historian Julius Held dismissed most of these attempts to identify the subject as mere myth-making and proposed that the subject be seen as an idealized, youthful Christian soldier, a Miles Christianus. The anonymity of Rembrandt's horseman fits neatly with Kittage's intentions in his painting. His rider, as Kittage calls him, is on his way to visit the sites of the death camps in Poland, many years after the war. I was inspired by a report someone wrote, who traveled on a train from Budapest to Auschwitz, to see what the doomed souls might have seen. He said the countryside was beautiful. By alluding to the wandering Jew, Kitaj makes a Jewish rider of Rembrandt's anonymous subject, replacing the confident youth looking out into the distance with an older scholarly type with his gaze lowered, immersed in his book. The conspicuously bright, almost white coat worn by Rembrandt's rider is echoed in the loose, casual jacket worn by Kitaj's subject, which, together with his bright shoes and red shirt, gives the rail traveler a certain conspicuous elegance, not unlike that of Rembrandt's youthful rider. The numerous weapons Rembrandt's horseback warrior carries, two swords, a bow, a quiver full of arrows, and an axe in his right hand, which is twisted so that the palm faces out, are transformed into the train passenger's three books. But Kitaj's Jewish rider maintains the same pose with the right arm bent and the, now empty, right hand twisted outwards and resting against the right thigh. An awkward, tense position, which seems not to suit the otherwise rather melancholy portrayal of a figure immersed in thought, and yet is unmistakably reminiscent of the pose of Rembrandt's subject. There is another, stronger reference which we perhaps only notice at a second glance. The horse which appears like a spectre of Rembrandt's mare, squeezed in between the reading passenger and the train seat. There is no mistaking the likeness of the horse to that of the Polish rider. The head stretching forwards with an open mouth, the pale coloring, the truncated tail. All the details correspond perfectly with Rembrandt's animal, which in turn defies all conventions of contemporary cavalry portraits. Countless art historians have racked their brains trying to make sense of Rembrandt's strangely ghostly-looking old nag. Where one reckons it is a thoroughbred, another sees only a plough horse. It was Held, in 1944, who was first to come up with a conclusive theory. "The horse," he writes, "certainly has something unusual about it. Compared with the rider, it is small and strangely fleshless. The general lack of flesh is particularly noticeable on the head, where the exaggerated dryness lends the horse a cadaverous expression." Held finds an answer in a sketch by Rembrandt, which is believed to be based on an anatomical specimen which could be seen at the time in Leiden's Anatomical Theatre. The drawing is of the skeleton of a horse being ridden by the skeleton of a man, who is holding a bone aloft in his right hand as though it were a weapon, while the left hand holds the reins. Rembrandt's horse in The Polish Rider, Held argues, is literally just skin and bones, a skeleton over which the painter has stretched a skin. Might Kitaj, the pictor doctus, scholarly painter, have recognized this possible background to Rembrandt's picture? Given his iconographic training and the fact that with Michael Podro as his model, he is putting an art historian into his picture, we can't be sure either way. The idea that beneath both Rembrandt's young warrior and his steed lurk two barely veiled skeletons fits well with the eerie voyage of a man traveling to see the murdered Jews. If Kitaj was, on the other hand, not aware of this role model behind Rembrandt's cavalry portrait, he must surely have recognized the deathly pale color that unfailingly evokes the fourth horseman of the apocalypse, and the curious shape of the head, described by Held as an exaggerated dryness. Of course, this dryness might not necessarily suggest a horse's cadaver or skeleton, but could be seen as a reference to a possible Arab origin of the horse, which presupposes, of course, that the painter of the Polish rider was aware of this genetic characteristic, and therefore was familiar with Arabian horses, or at least with pictures of them, which for a 17th century Dutch painter cannot be taken for granted. "Insofar as we really engage with a past work, we must remake it for ourselves," wrote Michael Podro, referring to the fundamental indeterminacy which marks all our knowledge, which we encounter as soon as we try to determine the exact dividing line between what we, as interpreters, see in a picture and what is actually present in it. The Hen. By shifting from Miles Christianus, Christian soldier, to Migrator Hebraicus, Jewish traveler, Kitaj's paraphrase gives rise to a number of other shifts, from young man to old, from warrior to scholar, from activity to reverie, from weapon to book. It is as though the painter, of whom his critics often complained that he was too literary, too intellectual, and who used to reply that some books have pictures and some pictures have books, wanted to reveal the Jewish writer's hidden weapon. Another detail stands out when we consider this change of key from Rembrandt to Guettage. Again, it is a gesture, the raised and bent left leg, which brings the Jewish writer's extended foot to the epicenter of the painting. The stretched foot now forms a contrast to the curled hand, and if we draw a line through those poles, the diagonal line would extend out to the smoking chimney in the landscape outside, while the shape of the hand links back precisely to the inspiration in Rembrandt. The position of the leg is in direct contrast. While the Polish rider sits atop his horse in a manly riding position, Kitaj's train traveler is riding side saddle. The reason may be purely practical. How else could the painter convey a riding posture in a train carriage? But with Kitaj, we can bet there is also a literary allusion at play here. The way a Jew mounts his horse, Friedrich Nietzsche once commented, is quite incredible and gives the impression that the Jews have never been a chivalrous race. In contrast to this historical cultural condescension, Theodor Herzl, in his 1902 novel, Altneuland, developed the idea of a virile young Jewish man who rides like a Cossack or the American Indians, singing Hebrew songs all the while. In fact, this debate about how virile or chivalrous the Jews are or were continually came back to the question of how well they could ride. The historian John Hoberman has traced this discussion, equating the exclusion of Jews from the riding experience with their exclusion from the experience of nature more generally. But even Hoberman cannot avoid noting the deep ambivalence within Judaism itself and its literature with regard to the phenomenon of the rider and the representation of power in the figure of a rider. Kitaj's Jewish rider, who rides in his train carriage, sitting side saddle on the cushion, still seems to have the shadow of this ancient discourse looming over him. The Jew who does not ride, an anathematized image that emerges even in the lightweight novels penned by Pyotr Nikolaevich Krasnov, the ataman of the Don Cossacks and a white general in the Civil War, when he wasn't out clashing with the Reds or leading his Cossacks into senseless, bitter combat. The most prominent representative of this trope is Leon Trotsky, the founder and commander of the Red Army. Placing the Cossack general at the center of a historical search for clues, Italian scholar Claudio Magris considers his depiction of Trotsky. To judge by the bilious portrait which Krasnov sketches in his novel, Trotsky's worst fault would seem to be that he didn't know how to ride a horse properly. Like all Jews, like all new men, those spiders, as Krasnov thought, spinning the web of mediations which in our world binds the individual. The anthropology of the Cossacks followed simple laws. Man is by nature a horseman. Atop his steed, he is in the image of God. The Cossack is born into the world a horseman, and everything he may lack before reaching complete manhood, he learns from his horse. The Jew, however, never learns to ride, and therefore never fully becomes a man. He finds an uncertain status somewhere halfway between humans and animals. As a Cossack and an ataman, Krasnov shared his way of thinking. As an author, he drew inspiration from the literary sources of anti-Semitism, from Gogol and Dostoevsky to more westward-looking, enlightened writers, such as Turgenev and Chekhov and others after them. There stretched a tradition that placed Jews somewhere in the animal kingdom. The Jew is defined according to an animalistic correlation, as writer Felix Philipp Ingold put it, and thereby denies him any metaphysical dimension, assigning him a monstrous existence and sphere of experience. Between Gogol and Dostoevsky, a type developed by which one could allegedly recognize a Jew. The cliché of the plucked chicken, pale, scrawny, and fidgety, with fuzzy hair and beard, this was the hackneyed depiction of the Jewish antihero. This pale, nervous little bird, the epitome of a lack of strength and courage, was introduced in the 19th century to replace the age-old stereotype of the Jewish swine. Little had changed. Jews were depicted as animals, just with different features. Until the end of the 19th century, the non-assimilated Jews in Russia occupied a position midway between a monkey and a dog, writes Ingold. And many testimonies show they were treated not merely like animals, but as though they actually were animals. It is to Gogol's animal comparisons and their influence on Russian literature that we can attribute the fact that, in Russia, there was barely a single positive image of the Jewish people until the time of the great pogroms and the anti-Jewish laws, regulations, and court cases of 1880. Turgenev finally rounds off the animal comparison when, in sketches from a hunter's album, he contrasts a thoroughbred, noble, and intelligent horse called Malek Adel, a marvel, no ordinary horse, with the wretchedness of the gaunt, miserable, and hysterical Jew, Moshe Leiber. The humiliation and bestialization of the Jewish man is compared to the elevation and humanization of the horse. Malek Adel, whose name historically was Safadin, the brother of Saladin, is an unusually noble animal, a kind of uber-beast, whose beauty and perfection requires admiration, even worship. Ordinary animals, on the other hand, are as neglected and abused as the Jews, and vice versa. As Jewish philosopher Michael Landman explains, for Jews this engenders the feeling of a kind of common destiny. Just as people see animals as outsiders and mistreat and kill them without any qualms when and where they please, they do the same with the Jews, with contempt. Animal and Jew are comrades in misfortune. This is why the Jew is doubly sensitive to the suffering of animals. He feels their suffering like his own. What looks like ethics is only the tip of an iceberg of mystery, the mystification of what is felt inside. Red Horseman. Mir Sherem is the name of a district west of Old Jerusalem, inhabited exclusively by ultra-Orthodox Jews. It is reminiscent of the Eastern European shtetl, and sounds like it too, with its residents often speaking Yiddish. The first time I wandered around it in the evening, I felt as if I had drifted into a bygone world, which seemed all the more alien and forbidden to me, belonging, as I do, to the nation that, like no other, bears the blame for the disappearance of this world. It was only at the end of the main street, from which the district inherits its name, that I was brought back to the present with a bump, or rather, it was something that seemed more modern to me, anyway. I was standing in front of a living statue. Before me loomed the largest equestrian monument I had ever seen. But this statue moved from time to time, the horse nodded his head, the metal on his bridle clinking. In the previous weeks, there had been some unrest in Mir Sherem, linked to the refusal by members of the Orthodox community to fulfill their civic duties. No longer stopping at passive resistance, as in the past, they had begun to forcibly restrain young men from their community who had defiantly signed up to join the army. Since then, this mounted policeman had been standing guard at the end of the road, on the lawn in front of the Ministry of Education, a large, heavily armed man on an enormous horse, watching out for the smallest sign of restlessness. As this centaur stood there in the half-light of dusk, he seemed to represent more than an ordinary security measure. He was a philosophical statement, a metaphysical proposition. There must have been a historically minded philosopher somewhere in the Jerusalem Police Department who thought up this antagonism of absolute tropes, the pure type of religious wrath, ready to surge at any time, and in opposition, the pure type of secular power, ready to strike at any time. The question of why the police officer should be mounted continued to puzzle me, however, and it was a while before I found a solution that seemed plausible. Jacob Hessing, a Jerusalem-based academic, showed me the historical constellation behind it. The man on the horse, he replied without hesitation, represents the Cossack. The Jews in Mir Sherem see a man on horseback watching them, or perhaps threatening them, and without realizing it, they react like their ancestors in the shtetl, when they saw the Cossacks at the gates. Even if their children and grandchildren cannot say what it is they fear, there is something in them, you might call it the collective memory, which feels a sense of alarm at the sight of a Cossack guard. As speculative as it was, Hessing's response was backed up by history. If we consider the history of Eastern European Jewry, we see a steady stream of pogroms. Starting in the mid-17th century, it swelled up towards the end of the 19th century, with major pogroms in 1881 to 1884 and 1903 to 1906, before finally coming to a climax with the catastrophes of the Russian Civil War, the Polish-Russian War, and the Nazi extermination camps and the Sonderkommando units. The Cossacks played only a peripheral role in the latter crimes against the Jews by Germany, insofar as some of them fought alongside the Wehrmacht against Russian partisans. But in almost all previous acts of mass violence against the Jewish population of Galicia, a historical region, part of which are now in Poland and Ukraine, the Cossack troops played a leading role. Even historians minded to be sympathetic towards them do not downplay the scale of the Cossacks' part in anti-Semitic violence, which recurred constantly from the time in 1648 that Bogdan Khmelnytsky went murdering and pillaging through the Jewish villages and neighborhoods of Ukraine. As noted in one recent study of anti-Semitism at the time of the Russian Revolution, their conduct meant the Cossacks were firmly integrated within the dominant anti-Semitic ideology of Tsarism. Their conduct did not change in the slightest during the revolution and the subsequent civil war. It was not only under white commanders such as Anton Denikin that the Cossacks regularly spearheaded the increasingly brutal systemic violence against the Jewish people. Even when they entered the service of the Bolsheviks, they carried on, the moment they were left to their own devices, hunting out Jews, murdering, and looting. Like no other unit of the Red Army, Budyonny's cavalry, made up largely of Cossacks who had defected to the Red Army, was known for its anti-Semitism and propensity for carrying out anti-Jewish pogroms. The young Jew who set off in midsummer 1920 at the peak of the Russo-Polish War, riding with the Cossacks and Budyonny's Red Cavalry, had to be on his guard. Besides coming from the deep south, the Crimean city of Odessa in his case, he had nothing in common with his new comrades. A bespectacled writer, an intellectual, who did not ride well and was interested in neither looting nor killing, the contrast to the rough riders of the Khanarmia could hardly be greater. As a war correspondent, Isaac Babel enjoyed a certain amount of freedom and was able to watch the commanders, Budyonny and Voroshilov, from close quarters. But he had to take constant care not to fall between the lines that opened up between the actual front lines, the zones of hatred where there was the constant threat of looting and pogroms. No one could wax more lyrically than Babel about the virtues of Soviet power. No one could rekindle extinguished hopes for better times like him. But was he himself truly convinced by his own words? Babel sees what he sees, and in his diary, the basis for his elaborately detailed stories, published as Red Cavalry, he holds firmly to what he believes. We are the vanguard. But of what? The population await their saviors. The Jews look for liberation, and in ride the Cuban Cossacks. Previously they rode with the whites, now they had sworn allegiance to the Soviets, but in reality they were waging their own war on their own terms. The Atamans, their leaders, writes Babel, acquired machine guns and joined up with the Red Army. That's as far as the heroic epic goes. The reality is much more profane. This isn't a Marxist revolution. It's a Cossack rebellion, out to win all and lose nothing. This is to be understood in material or materialistic terms. Our army is out to line its pockets. This isn't a revolution. It's a rebellion of Cossack wild men. What was it that motivated Babel to sign up to go to the front? The hope of fame? It certainly came, practically overnight, in the wake of the publication of Red Cavalry in 1924. Was it an adventurous streak? A desperate attempt to prove his virility? The senselessness of the violence he witnessed left no room for heroic posturing. Did he want to see the war up close? To understand it, warts and all? He certainly had an eyeful. Isaac Babel, propagandist for the Red Army, became the Thucydides of the last European cavalry war. His writings form the bulk of the very few accounts we have of these most obscure campaigns of the 20th century. Often his observations are no longer than two lines. The village, deserted, a light at HQ, Jewish detainees, Budyonny's men bring communism, a woman weeps. Day after day, Babel, the Jew riding with the cavalry, has to watch as other Jews are humiliated, raped, robbed, and murdered. And what of it? Perhaps a soldier gets the whip for stealing from a comrade. Perhaps a brigade will be punished for disobeying orders and shooting prisoners. But who is going to trouble themselves about a little pogrom here and there? Who cares about a handful of dead Jews, 2 dozen women raped, a crowd of howling and bleeding children, burning synagogues, looted houses? All that is the daily stuff of war. Only a madman like Babel takes any notice. Yet even he tarries with those trampled and crushed by history no longer than necessary. The war goes on, and somehow everything returns to how it was before. Night, Cossacks, all just as it was when the temple was destroyed. I go out to sleep in the yard, stinking and damp. Babel rides, though badly. As far as the Cossacks are concerned, he's a coward. He has to kill a goose in front of them before they're even halfway convinced of his manliness. The fact that he is still able to sympathize with them is not a feeling based on identification with the aggressor of his people. Babel does not hide how raw, greedy, and violent the Cossacks are. But he also sees what they are not. They are not bureaucrats, ideologists, or strategists. They are wild riders, primitive and unrestrained, a hot and unpredictable culture. The revolution ought not to be left in their hands, and they ought not to be left in the hands of the revolution. The terror of Galicia now, but tomorrow they will be devoured by the war, and the next day they will be swallowed up by the post-war reality, the plan, the state, the party. Then they too will be the victims, downtrodden like those they massacre now. People like the Cossacks are not made to be leaders on the world stage. They lack the cold, calculating instinct for power. Splendid comradeship, solidarity, love of horses. A Cossack's horse occupies a quarter of his day. Endless bartering, arguments, the role and life of the horse. I understand now, Babel wrote in August 1920, just before the tide turned in the Russian Civil War, what a horse means to a Cossack or cavalryman. He saw horsemen who had lost their horses, wandering in a daze, as bereft infantrymen along the dusty roads in the blazing heat. Unhorsed riders on hot, dusty roads, carrying their saddles, sleeping like the dead men on other people's wagons, rotting horses everywhere. The talk is all about horses. Horses are martyrs. Horses are long-suffering. And later, the horse is everything. Their names, Stepan, Misha, little brother, old girl. The horse is his savior. The Cossack is aware of that every minute of the day, but can nonetheless thrash it like mad. Far from wanting to discover the noble savage in the Cossack, Babel finds a level on which Cossacks, Jews, and horses all come together. It is the realm of the animal, the realm inhabited by those who are destined to die sooner or later, probably very soon. But perhaps everyone and every horse he encounters in this hot Galician summer are not merely morituri, doomed to die, but are in fact already long dead, or shot, slain, deceased on leave. Must not forget Brody and those pitiful figures, neither the barbers nor the Jews, like visitors from the other world, nor the Cossacks on the streets. History repeats itself, and the historian, well-versed in deciphering the signature of the future in the past, sees figures of the past emerging from the future. The Jewish cemetery outside Milan, Babel writes in July 1920, hundreds of years old, gravestones have toppled over, almost the same shape, oval at the top, the cemetery is overgrown with grass. It has seen Khmelnytsky, now Budyonny, unfortunate Jewish population, everything repeats itself. Now that whole story, Poles, Cossacks, Jews, is repeating itself with stunning exactitude. The only new element is communism. 11 decades after Paris had feted the victorious Cossacks in 1814, when in reality the French were frightened to death of them, the same city received many Cossacks after their anarchic cavalry adventure of the Civil War came to a bitter end. While Budyonny would rise swiftly through the Soviet nomenclature and survive all the purges, for those who were late to change sides in 1919 to 1920, Russia and the old motherland on the rivers Don and Dnieper were cut off forever. Impoverished Cossack noblemen had to scrape a living working as doormen in Paris nightclubs or as taxi drivers, if they did not join a circus troupe and continue to live the nomadic life. R.B. Kataj, the painter who in 1984 began painting the Jewish rider, his paraphrase of Rembrandt's The Polish Rider, had 22 years earlier produced a painting that alluded to the image of the riders, horses, and Jews of Galicia. It is considered now one of the key works of the then-emerging London school and is now owned by the Tate Gallery. Its title is Isaac Babel Riding with Budyonny. In the late 1930s, Isaac Babel was targeted by the Soviet secret police, the NKVD. The fact that he could just about ride a horse saved his life a couple of times in 1920. It couldn't help him now. On the 27th of January 1940, Babel was shot at Butyrka Prison in Moscow. This is also a date to remember when we recount the many points in time that marked the end of the age of the horse. The first decade of the 20th century did, however, bring one Jewish rider to prominence. She, a young Russian communist, came to Palestine for the first time in 1904. From 1907, she was involved with Bar Jura, a Jewish self-defense group led by Israel Shochat, her future husband. The historian Tom Segev describes this militant woman as the mother of the kibbutz movement, a fanatical young woman who rode through the hills of Galilee in Arabian robes. Her name was Manya Wibushevitz. In Palestine, she was one of the co-founders of a rural community, an early form of the kibbutz, and one of the first members of the Hashema, Watchman Militia, the forerunner of the Israeli Defense Forces. Even the male members of the new security force, founded in April 1909, did not think of abandoning their Arab-style robes. Once they had managed to raise enough money to arm themselves and to acquire horses, the young Jews formed a colorful cavalry inspired by Bedouin, Druze, Circassian, and even Cossack influences. For a moment, it looked as though Theodor Herzl's dream of strong, riding, and singing Jews had come true. The terrifying specter of the Cossacks was momentarily chased away. 10 years later, in 1920, Hashema was superseded by the better organized and better armed Haganah, the next intermediate step towards the Army of the State of Israel, founded in 1948. The strong man behind this new paramilitary organization was Vladimir Zev Jabotinsky, who, together with Joseph Trumpeldor, founded the Jewish Legion during the Second World War. Like Babel, 14 years his junior, Jabotinsky also came from Odessa, where his widowed mother ran a stationery shop. It may well have been in this store that the young Isaac Babel bought his first pencils when he started to write. Part 2. A Phantom of the Library. Knowledge. It would have been the summit of good fortune if the lad had got the horses ready for his master in Histrasse, the bay that Bob had taken a shine to, and the chestnut. They would have been standing there, with their long necks and their snaffle bits, flicking their tails, clattering gently as they lowered their hindquarters. It would be like a Munich child seeing the world like a painting that was brought to life, a vision from an otherworldly world, like the horses Albrecht Adam from Nordlingen painted, An Evening's Rest After the Battle, Russia, 1812. Hermann Heipel, the half violin. At some point in every historian's professional life, he feels that Rousseauian temptation. He finds a new source, poses an original question, and starts to dream that he might be the first to have reached some uncharted territory, a new South Pole of historical inquiry. Might he have stumbled upon an as-yet unexplored subject? It was a thought that crossed my mind, too, in the early days of my research into the horse as the focus of a possible history. For a moment, I too dreamed I held something like an objet brut in my hand, a crude mineral, not yet labored with interpretations. Over time, I could not help realizing that the opposite was the case. Horses had more meanings than bones. Since the time of Xenophon, horse experts of every kind, whether they be connoisseurs, handlers, breeders, farriers, or cavalrymen, have never tired of sharing their equine knowledge in lengthy tracts with a readership which appears at any time in history to have been broad and extensive. The result is we see not only long, diachronic investigations into the traditions of horse-related knowledge, but also the migration of this practical and theoretical knowledge amongst the most diverse cultures and environments. This book cannot contain every thread of research into hippological knowledge throughout history from Plato to NATO, or every trail it has followed from the ancient Orient to the stables of modern-day Asil breeders. To capture it all would far exceed the scope of this book and the chronological period of interest. My focus is to try to understand and describe how the end of the equestrian age played out, how it was that humans and horses went their separate ways and yet, at the same time, remained so interconnected in the literary, metaphorical, and imaginary realms. But to understand how the fringes originated, we have to look into the fabric of the rug. To make sense of the process of man and horse's separation, we need to go back and examine their coexistence. This includes looking at the extent and quality of knowledge resulting from man's work with horses. We need to pinpoint the locations where this knowledge was traded, identify the agents, and reconstruct the negotiations carried out between them. In other words, we need to delve deeper into the history of equine knowledge, picking up the thread an entire century earlier. This knowledge of horses, which has grown continuously since the beginning of the modern era, saw a particular boom from the second half of the 18th century. As the study of horses flourished, it found new markets and new media, magazines, almanacs, engravings, paintings, and a deluge of literature which flooded the continent. England became the laboratory for racing and breeding, while France witnessed the birth of the veterinary clinic. The other horse cultures of Europe also picked up speed and, following these two guiding stars, they began to establish schools and clinics, to open racecourses and to restructure stud farms and cavalries. If it was already seen as a science or a scholarly subject, the study of horses in the 18th century did not in any way correspond to today's academic standards. Structured according to the practical needs of the connoisseur, this science offered advice and instruction, training and warnings. But it remained a science of passionate amateurs. The know-how of the aficionado gradually morphed into the beau monde of the breeders and buyers, racehorse owners and the bourgeois parvenus who adopted a cavalier perspective and managed to leap over class barriers. A knowledge of horses was a tangible skill possessed by farriers and riding instructors, dealers, and owners, including practical guidance about feeding, stabling, and doctoring, including what to do when the mare is in heat but the stallion is inexperienced, plus any other complications of these liaisons dangereuses. It could also take the form of artistic proficiency, training the hand and eye of the artist seeking success as a painter of sport and animal portraits. Not unlike the link that developed between the visual arts and human medicine, there was also a lively give and take between the veterinary and art worlds. The dissecting table and the drawing board were never far apart, and the windows had a shared view onto the racetrack. The 19th century built on the practical traditions of animal husbandry and breeding, horsemanship and dressage, and saw the publication of classic texts such as Count George von Lendorf's Handbook for Horse Breeders. As veterinary surgeons gradually split away from the smithy, the traditional setting for horse doctoring, finding a new home in veterinary colleges and clinics, the 19th century zeal for knowledge opened up new conundrums, giving rise to new research styles and techniques that were no longer limited to the human sciences. The horse, in the early days of mechanization, still man's most important companion economically, militarily, and socially, became the prominent subject of a new kind of positivist research. In studies and laboratories, the horse became the focus of research into linguistics, economics, iconography, geography, and intelligence. The results of these empirical and experimental studies were of varying quality. Some had political implications, while others appear curiously idiosyncratic, and not just from a modern perspective, but besides the political and cultural relevance, all were also of significance militarily. Knowledge is not a static entity. On the contrary, indeed, it is a pleonasm when we speak of migrating knowledge. The question is not whether, but how knowledge travels. What material form does it take? Which social groups control its dissemination? And which institution